This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Unsere Krankenhäuser sind immer für uns da, Tag und Nacht, in ganz Deutschland. Sie möchten mehr zur neuen Krankenhausreform wissen? Dann sind Sie hier richtig. Krankenhaus-mit-zukunft.de. Eine Information des Bundesministeriums für Gesundheit.
Thanks for downloading this edition of The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. Late last year, the Indian Prime Minister waged war on so-called black money, cash that's either not declared for tax purposes or obtained illegally. He did this by banning the country's most widely used banknotes. It's a process known as demonetization. So what effect has this radical policy had on the country's economy?
I'm going to interrupt you because the Prime Minister is walking out of the door.
Imagine if tonight our broadcast was interrupted by an important surprise announcement.
We're going to hear from the Prime Minister.
Looking gravely down the lens, she announces that from midnight tonight, all 10 and 20 pound notes will be declared invalid. You'd hear that, immediately think, my God, what does that mean for me? What does it mean for all of us? And we're a people who only conduct around half of our transactions in cash. Now imagine you live somewhere where pretty much every transaction is made in cash, where you wouldn't even be able to buy any food without it. And that will give you some sense of what happened in India at the beginning of November when Prime Minister Narendra Modi addressed his country's 1.2 billion people.
To break the grip of corruption and black money, we have decided that the 500 rupee and 1,000 rupee currency notes presently in use will no longer be legal tender from midnight to night.
Unsurprisingly, nearly 3 months later, India and its economy are still reeling from the note ban. Later, we'll be asking what the impact of it all has been and will still be. But first, here's the BBC's South Asia correspondent Justin Rowlett, who's based in Delhi, with a reminder of how and why, overnight, India wiped out 86% of its cash.
I'd assumed there'd be no significant news coming out of India on November the 8th, at least none that could compete with the big international story of the day, the US elections. So I'd arranged to meet two friends at a Goan restaurant in a trendy suburb of Delhi. Sachin was in the middle of a very funny and very scandalous anecdote about meeting Donald Trump. I was never to hear the punchline, because halfway through I got a call from a journalist colleague asking if I'd heard the news. He told me about the astonishing surprise address the Indian Prime Minister had just made to the nation.
Today, I'll be speaking to you about some critical issues and important decisions.
I rushed to the TV.
There comes a time in the history of country's development when a need is felt for a strong and decisive step. For years, this country has felt that corruption, black money, and terrorism are holding us back in the race towards development.
It was immediately apparent that Mr. Modi's plan was both incredibly bold and incredibly risky. Within a couple of hours, I was broadcasting on the World Service.
India is overwhelmingly a cash economy, so this affects absolutely everybody. And I cannot tell you how shocked ordinary Indians are. There's a day tomorrow when the banks are going to be closed. And then on Thursday, the banks reopen, stocked with these new 500 and 2,000 rupee notes. And you can go in and you can change the money that you've got for new money. The idea is that if you go in with a few hundred dollars worth, they'll be fine. They'll change it for you. They won't ask any questions. If you go in with a few hundred thousand dollars worth, they'll say, well, and where exactly did you get this cash from? And that's the idea. The idea is to squeeze out this illegal money from the economy.
Or at least that's what we thought was going to happen. Except, as it turned out, the government had only just begun printing out the new notes and there was virtually no cash around. Suddenly, it seemed, the entire 1.2 billion population of India, the world's seventh biggest economy, was, as I explained in a TV report, joining one giant bank queue.
Tempers are beginning to fray. They've been queuing for hours, hoping to change notes the government suddenly banned on Tuesday night. A lucky few make it inside the bank.
I've been to two, three banks. There is no cash everywhere. We don't have 100 rupee notes to run a house right now. And there's so much of line. So what we can do now?
And if it was bad in Mumbai, it was worse elsewhere. 90% of all business in India is done in cash, and now there was none around, with distressing consequences for millions upon millions of people.
May I have your attention, please?
Teams from the BBC's Delhi Bureau fanned out across the country. Everywhere we found the same queues, the same stories of stalled businesses and disrupted lives. This man is from the eastern state of Bihar.
The cash crisis is why we have to leave the city and go back home to our village. We never expected that we would be reduced to becoming destitute in this manner, that our children would go hungry.
Every aspect of life was affected, as this man from Rajasthan on the opposite side of India explained.
It's my daughter's wedding tomorrow, and I need money to pay for everything. I have nothing at the moment. They told us to deposit our old money, so I gave the bank everything I had. Now they are not giving me anything back.
So why did Mr. Modi do it? When he announced the policy, he said the target was what Indians call black money. That means the corrupt cash held by criminals and terrorists, but also the stashes of untaxed cash tens of millions of ordinary Indians hold. Because so much business is done in cash here, it's very easy to evade tax, and many, many Indians do. Figures released last year showed just 1% of the population paid income tax in 2013. Mr. Modi was hoping his surprise move would catch people unawares. They wouldn't be able to put all their money in a bank without alerting the tax authorities and facing a hefty fine. He estimated perhaps as much as 20% of all the cash in circulation was black money and therefore anticipated a massive windfall for India. He thought perhaps as much as 4 trillion rupees, that's about 40 billion pounds, would not be exchanged. Not only that, the move would deliver a powerful warning not to evade tax in future. The problem is, it didn't work.
Right, so I'm at my local bank branch now. There are still restrictions on how much money you can take out, but the queues have almost entirely disappeared, which is a great relief for everyone.
Good morning. Could I take out 20,500, please? Thank you very much indeed. Can I throw this away?
Okay.
So Mr. Modi's issue was that he got back way, way more money than he was expecting. Virtually all the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes were handed in. So why is that? Well, it may be that his estimates of how much black money there was out there were too high, or alternatively, and this is what most analysts seem to believe, people simply found ways to launder their stashes of black cash back into the banks. And there's been a very clear change of emphasis in the way the government talks about the policy. You hear a lot less about black money now, a lot more about how demonetization is a tool to persuade Indians to move from using cash and into what they like to call here the digital economy. Here's Mr. Modi speaking at New Year.
Positive change has always found space in our country. We can now see a positive momentum toward digital transaction in India. More and more people are transacting digitally.
There has certainly been a very dramatic increase in digital transactions, but at the same time, the International Monetary Fund has cut its growth forecast for India by one percentage point. That means India is very likely to have to hand the title of the fastest growing major economy back to China. So has the policy failed? Well, Indians will have the chance to make their views heard in a series of state elections in the next few months. But you might be surprised what the opinion polls are suggesting. They show that lots of Indians are actually very supportive of Mr. Modi's extraordinary experiment.
Well, Justin Rowlett is joining me now from the BBC studio in Delhi, where he's alongside the journalist and biographer of Narendra Modi, Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, the Reuters journalist Douglas Buzvine, and Ila Patnaik, a professor at the National Institute of Public Finance and Policy and a former economic advisor to the Modi government. Ila Patnaik, can you tell us how shocked you were by Modi's announcement?
I was absolutely shocked. That was the last thing I expected. I had heard about this proposal for a while, you know, coming from unexpected corners, but never actually took it seriously because being an economist, you don't expect 86% of the currency, which is really the medium of exchange. These are not high denomination notes. You don't expect those to be withdrawn, and that too with a four-hour notice. So I just couldn't believe it, actually.
Now, give our listeners some kind of idea how important cash is in India. I mean, we struggle to imagine what would happen in Britain if we suddenly withdrew notes.
Yeah, so about 3% of transactions were, on the 7th of November, made digitally. 97% of all transactions in India were made by cash. So it's pretty much the dominant medium of exchange. We don't have internet connectivity everywhere. There are no point of sale machines through which cards can be used. There are shops which, even today actually, are unable to accept digital payments. So cash was the main medium of exchange in terms of number of transactions. Certainly, all small transactions are made in cash. So when I say 97% of the volume of transactions rather than the value of transactions, Right. Then it's really about almost literally every small transaction is made with cash.
What is being referred to when we refer to black money?
One, it is money on which taxes have been evaded. So it might be that the activity that you were involved in was legal, but you did not pay taxes on it. And so the money or the income that you earn is black income. The second is money obtained through illegal means, corruption, bribery. So it's something that we know exists. We know we have to solve it. Yet there hasn't been enough done to address the issue.
Douglas Buzvine, if I could turn to you. You and your team of reporters at Reuters pieced together afterwards how this Modi initiative was actually pulled off and kept secret. Tell us the story of that.
Right. Well, this was a classic example of Modi's modus operandi. We call it Modi operandi. he tends to involve a very small and trusted group of advisors, and directly involved were probably no more than half a dozen. The top guy, he was in the finance ministry, but he had a history of working very closely with Modi, going back to Modi's days as chief minister of Gujarat. So this
Which is an Indian state.
That's an Indian state in the west of the country. That's where Modi's from. He came to power in 2014, swept to power on the Modi wave, and in part a promise to bring back all that black cash. So it was a political product and a political promise that he had to deliver on. So they hatched a plan in utmost secrecy. We don't really believe that many of the cabinet ministers knew until the day of the announcement. Nor, in fact, did the central bank have a full picture. Yeah, sure, it was printing new banknotes, but we found out subsequently that it was advised to recommend the action the day before it was announced. So I think you can say pretty safely that the Reserve Bank of India was railroaded into it. And on the day of the announcement, there was a lot of cloak and dagger. As Justin mentioned in his piece, it was election day in the US. No one was expecting this. The first sign that something was up was the call to the cabinet meeting. Don't bring your mobile phones. And in fact...
Is that what they told them?
That's right. It was a little bit unusual. And as we understand it, Modi, in fact, recorded his address to the nation before he convened his full cabinet meeting. And so you can kind of picture the scene. He breaks the news to his ministers, says, "This is my idea. I'll take responsibility for it if it goes wrong." And we have that from three cabinet sources. And then, swivels in his chair and says, "Now, watch my address." OK. And then he goes, "I've got to go and tell the president now." So it was really a classic, as I say, modi operandi, trusted aides, no collegial approach. And as we know afterwards from the experience, maybe a lack of understanding of money beyond it being a political product, the black money specter, but how money flows through an economy appears not to have been properly understood in this entire exercise. And that's where the trouble has hit, with the circulation and reintroduction of cash, totally stopping payments to workers.
How did he manage to prepare for this in complete secrecy?
Elements of research were assigned to economists, bureaucrats, even I think to Ilapak Naik's institute. But it was diced and sliced in a way that it was like a jigsaw puzzle that nobody had all the pieces to.
Oh, come on, you're kidding, Douglas.
No. Well, a select group of people directly in the know who were directly involved, and a small backroom team in his bungalow in Lutyens, Delhi, that was cobbling it together. And
I can see the dramatisation right now. You know, somebody's going to make some money out of this in India, even if other people have lost it. Was the secrecy itself what was responsible for the Bank of India not printing up sufficient notes? I mean, in other words...
Well, yes, it was, but I think it was in the nature of the plan. If you started running up the printing presses too far in advance, this would have been bound to get out, and people would have front-run the demonetization. They would have put their money in the bank, they would have switched it into gold, got it offshore, put it into dodgy real estate transactions, that sort of thing. So they were worried about leaks. It did start to leak, and as we understand it, they moved it up by several days or over a week ahead of what they were planning in terms of the launch date. And they hurried it up, which inevitably led them to not be ready, not to have all those banknotes that they needed. So they would have needed weeks and months, in fact, to really fill the coffers and distribute the cash. So I think in the end, they were willing to accept a pretty hefty disruption for the greater good as they saw it.
This was the most extraordinary act of riskiness. I mean, can you tell us, as his biographer, Nilanjan, whether this is characteristic of the man, characteristic of Modi himself?
The entire demonetization exercise, smacks of all that Modi has done. Just he has a great idea, which he thinks is simply going to work, but he does not have a big picture because he does not do his homework properly. This is quite similar to several programs which he did in Gujarat as a chief minister, where he took a decision and then did all the paperwork later. The only problem in this case was that the paperwork involved much more than just simply filing notes in office files. It meant, printing money, which was simply not possible in such a short period of time. This was an economic step with a political intent, basically reflecting that over the past 2.5 years, the way there has been a sense of drift in the government, that he was feeling that time is running out, he has to set his ship back on the sails, get everything going again, have a couple of good so-called programs or policies running, show it to the people, once again start getting mandate in elections. So he reached a moment where he had to do something. So he just simply took this economic action, justified it by forwarding a very nationalistic, narrow, parochial idea, linked it with nationalistic sentiment as to why this was necessary. But the basic thing is that he also tried to do what I call, you know, a paradigm shift in the core electoral constituency of the BJP. The BJP has drawn...
That's his party.
The BJP has drawn its strength for the last 7 decades that it has been in existence, some form or the other, primarily from the middle-class trader community, which has been its core electoral support. So the best way he could possibly hope to ensure that his party was guaranteed more than the 31% of popular vote which he secured in 2014 was by giving a more proletarian character to the BJP. This is what he did. So within days of announcing demonetization, he started saying that all my programs of this government are directed to improve the conditions of the poor. I have taken up the very bold step of demonetization because I want to eradicate black money. This is going to eradicate corruption. And then he said, this is what causes poverty.
I'll come to that in a moment, but I just want to kind of characterise what you're saying about Modi himself, which that he comes from a nationalist background. His BJP party was historically associated with Hindu nationalism. That he's won this broader support, 31%, I think you said, of the electorate. But he needs to maintain this broader level of support. There's a kind of paradox here, which is you would have thought that he would want to take relatively few risks in order to consolidate his support. And yet what he's done is taken an enormous risk in order to try and consolidate that support. Very briefly, could you explain that paradox?
He's basically tried to consolidate the Hindus against the other communities. If you go back to his 8th of November speech, you know, when he made this dramatic announcement, it's laced with a lot of latent Hindutva. The announcement was exactly a week after Diwali, the Festival of Lights, which is a very important festival for India, Hindus. He made several references to Diwali and said that just the way during Diwali, the Hindus as a practice and custom, they clean their homes, throw out all the garbage out. So this is the time that you have to cleanse India. He referred to the fight against black money and corruption, which was starting with demonetization, as a Mahayagna. Now, this is a typical Hindu ritual which is intended to be a ritual to please gods, and it continues for several days, weeks, months, maybe even years. The moment you do that, in religion you invoke fire, water, various other natural elements. That is when you make it a civilizational battle. So it fits into the entire framework of a Hindu nationalistic political strategy.
That is so interesting, and one can't help thinking that if you were to translate the Yagna into English, it might come out like something like draining the swamp. Justin Rowlett, one of the things that you would have thought, it's so difficult for me to comprehend, is the thought that the people who were the very worst affected in the first instance by this were exactly the people that Modi wanted to get to vote for him.
Well, that's true. And as Nilanjan says, you know, one of the big constituencies that supported Modi at the election were these kind of hardworking, aspirant, entrepreneurial small businessmen who were exactly the kind of people, frankly, who you'd expect to build up these stashes of cash on which tax hadn't been paid. And then, of course, the vast majority of Indians, most of whom are poor, would be kind of in line as well because they were overwhelmingly users of cash. And that's what's so striking about how this has played out in India is that he seems to have persuaded people that whether it worked or not, this has been a blow by the poor against the rich, which he's kind of overseen. He's very much, as we heard, structured it in that way, and he's been very successful, surprisingly successful, actually, in persuading people that that's the case.
Ila Patnaik, let's talk about the consequences. I mean, in terms of the policy's stated objective of tackling all that black money, has it worked?
I don't think it's worked at all. And everybody here in the country agrees that, you know, since all the money came back, it's not really something that the government was expecting. They thought that cash would be either burnt or thrown away by...
Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure that everybody understands what this means. The government was expecting that a fair bit of the money wouldn't come back. In other words, people would say, oh, look, if I take the money in, they'll know that I've got this money that's supposed to be black money, so I'll take the hit and I won't bring it back. And actually what happened was that all the money did come back and it was exchanged for new notes.
David, I just want to butt in here. You know, your specific thing as to how it was done. Basically, within less than 12 hours, agencies had come up virtually all over the country. They hired people to exchange notes because the government had not frozen the number of times you could exchange notes. So you had the same guy lining up about seven times, eight times, exchanging 4,500 rupees into new currency or the existing currency notes which were legal tender at that point. That was one way it was done. The other way it was
done... So you had chaps just getting in line again and again and again and again.
And they were being paid. I have spoken to several people who are getting 500 rupees for exchanging every 4,500. There was also a going rate to convert money. I could have walked into a place with 50,000 rupees and say, okay, you get 30,000 rupees back. You don't get 20,000 rupees back. I spoke to several businessmen. I said, why are you doing it? They came up with an ingenious argument. They said, look, this 50,000 rupees or 100,000 rupees, it is, in any way, it is illegal money which we have not paid tax on. So had we paid tax on it, we would have paid 30%. So instead of 30%, we have paid 35%, maybe 40%. So my net loss is just 5 to 10%. In business, these good days and bad days are very common. So I have been able to escape with the least possible loss at this particular stage. I will get another opportunity to recover this and I'll bounce back once again. So basically, I think Mr. Modi very grossly underestimated the capacity of the underworld, of the people who are in the business of collecting wealth by evading taxes.
And you're absolutely right, though. What they did, they went to villages where perhaps there were a cascade of family connections, and they said to everyone in the village, most of whom had bank accounts as part of an initiative the government had to try and encourage people to become part of the formal economy. They had these stagnant bank accounts. They said, listen, put your money in here and we'll pay you however much they paid them. So they would recruit people, perhaps of the same caste, perhaps family members, huge numbers of them, to put cash into these bank accounts. And I think on this note, we should say that the government has said it's going to investigate these kind of weird activities. So a dormant bank account suddenly has thousands of rupees in it. They're going to investigate it and seek to kind of, you know, chase up any tax that's been evaded. Yeah. So it may be that over the coming year or two, it's going to take ages, we're talking literally tens, hundreds of millions of people, they may claim that they've recovered, you know, tax from these kind of accounts.
I don't know what the Hindi equivalent is for locking the stable door after the horse has bolted, but I presume that there is one. Douglas Buzzfine, if we could amplify this. I mean, do you think that Modi has paid any kind of price for this policy at all?
Not yet electorally. His party has in fact won and done rather well in some local elections. The big one is coming up. We'll find out soon enough. But I think it's fair to say that his political opponents failed comprehensively to capitalise on this. He totally broke the mould of politics. He went from being all talk, no action, to all action, perhaps not enough talk. I don't think we've yet seen a tipping point or a political backlash. Uttar Pradesh is the biggest election anywhere this year, I believe. 200 million people. It's kind of Brazil. OK, it's a real big one, and we watch out for that. The opposition is coalescing, and it's all to play for. If he comes through that pretty well, I think he's got a good chance of sticking around for a while, but let's see.
Let's see indeed. That's the briefing room for this week. My very great thanks to the BBC's Justin Rowlett, to Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, to Douglas Buzzfine and Ila Patnaik. The briefing room will be back next week with, well, who knows what.
You've been listening to The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. The producer was me, Phil Kemp. The sound engineer was Graham Puddifoot. Research was by Serena Tarling. We're always grateful to hear what people think of The Briefing Room. If you'd like to let us know your views, there's an easy way to do it. Just leave a rating, or even better, a review on iTunes or your podcast provider. Thanks for listening.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.